This morning I'm going to talk about one of our new texts in our new liturgy book, which actually is one of the most ancient ones in the liturgy book. It's called the Song of Realizing the Tao. And it was probably written sometime in the 8th century by Yang Jia Xuanzue. This is a translation by one of our more recent Zen ancestors, Robert Aitken. And it's a very abridged version of the whole of this text, which goes on for pages and pages and pages. In Chinese, it's called the Zheng Dao Ko, and in Japanese, the Sho Do Ka. And it's revered by Zen practitioners. It's been revered for all these centuries since it was written by this person, Yang Jia Xuanzue, who was a Dharma heir of Hui Neng. And some of you may recall that Hui Neng is our sixth ancestor. He's part of our lineage dedication, a very seminal figure in Chinese Zen. There are many stories told about Hui Neng. You probably know some of them. But it's interesting that this student of his, Yang Jia Xuanzue, has almost the opposite origin story to Hui Neng. Hui Neng being an illiterate peasant from the south who came to the teacher, who recognized him immediately and then made him stay for 6 months threshing rice in the rice threshing hut until he recognized him. When Yang Jia Xuanzue came to Hui Neng's place, he was also instantly recognized, and as soon as that recognition happened, there's a nice long dialogue that's been recorded between teacher and student demonstrating the student's great capacity. And as soon as he was recognized, he decided to leave, and Hui Neng begged him to stay. Very different. A different kind of teacher-student relationship than what Hui Neng had with his own teacher. And so he finally relented and he stayed one night. And so his nickname in Chinese Zen is the Overnight Guest. So this is a piece by the Overnight Guest. He was also immersed deeply in other forms of practice. He was he's revered by Taoist practitioners in China, and also by the Tendai practitioners, which is an esoteric form of Buddhism. And there, some of those elements appear in this text. If you have been reciting it with us, we've recited it a few times now through our coming and going session as well as this morning, you might sense that it has a different flavor than some of the Japanese texts that we chant. It's got this real Taoist flavor, and it begins, of course, the Song of Realizing the Tao is one of the translations of the title. And the Tao, as many of you know, is a Chinese word that was already in use in China when Buddhism came to China, and it means the way things are. So sometimes we use this word Tao, the way, to talk about reality, the Dharmakaya, the body of the teachings. It's a translation from Sanskrit to Chinese of a concept that the Chinese knew very well, the way things are, reality. In this translation by Robert Aitken, the word is actuality. Sometimes it's used that way. And this teacher, Yang Jia, is pointing us to the kind of life we've been talking about for this whole coming and going session so far. This life that is centered in something that, in fact, doesn't come and go. Something that is deeply reliable. We've been giving it all kinds of names, but it's something that can't really be named. Every time we name it, we limit our understanding of it. And, of course, the mind loves to name and the mind loves to make concepts. We've also been discussing this. And we can't stop any of that. And Yangjie doesn't ask us to stop any of that. He describes the phenomena of the world as continually in motion, never stopping, never relenting, but also describes a way that it's possible to live in the middle of all this coming and going, in the mind, in the heart, in the physical body. And he points right at the beginning. He says, "There is the leisurely one, walking the Tao, beyond philosophy, not avoiding fantasy, not seeking truth." It really touches me that he starts out this way by talking about somebody who's walking the way, walking this path of awakening. This is not a path that we encounter only in our sitting practice. It's a path we encounter in every moment of our lives. There's no going off the path. There's recognizing that we are on the path, one step after the other. He's beyond philosophy. He's leisurely. He's not engaged with a lot of tension or effort here, but the kind of effort we might say that the Buddha himself described as the tension in a string, on a stringed instrument, that is just the right tension that allows music, a tone, to come when it's plucked. If it's too loose, it just makes a sound like whang, nothing really musical about that. And of course, if it's too tight, it breaks. So this is the middle way, the leisurely way. Not doing, but not just doing, something in between, something that really so many of the great teachers in our Zen heritage have pointed to in all their different styles and personalities. Finding just the right amount to encounter what's been here from the beginning. And there's no avoiding of fantasy. We're not trying to get rid of anything, but only to recognize fantasy when it arises. Not seeking truth, not trying to seek something that we make a conception of, that we call truth with a capital T. Not seeking anything, but as we like to say in our way here in Boundless Way, receiving. So we don't get rid of anything and we don't grasp after anything. This is a process of recognizing, of acknowledging, of knowing in every pore, in every bone, in every cell of our body. And he says this line, which is, of course, again, so important to us. The real nature of ignorance is the Buddha nature itself. And this points to the teaching we've also been going over so often in so many different ways, that there is this wholeness. The world is complete. The world is not lacking anything. We make lack by dividing, isolating, saying, "I wish it was like this," or "if only." We make the lack by saying that things can be divided and discarded. Things can certainly be divided, and things can be discarded. But this is a deep, deep, fundamental misunderstanding of what we're doing. We are not carving off pieces of the world or pieces of the self to leave us with our ideal image of the way things should be and the way we should be. There's no discarding. The empty, delusory body. That's an interesting combination of adjectives here. Empty and delusory. This is the very body of the Dharma. So our attempts to perfect ourselves, to find something we call enlightenment, all of these attempts, of course, are part of the way, but they're not going to lead us to any place because we're not going anywhere. We keep walking, but we are walking home. We're walking back to our fundamental nature. We're returning. So he, this is such a long text, I'm not going to talk about everything in it, but I want to highlight a couple of other parts of it. The beautiful verse, mental and physical reactions come and go like clouds in the empty sky. Greed, hatred, and ignorance, the three poisons that get us in so much trouble, appear and disappear like bubbles on the surface of the sea. There's some kind of fundamental trust that we begin to recognize and acknowledge. We yearn for this trust before we know that it's already here. And this trust is that everything comes and goes. All of our troubles, all of our difficult mental formations and emotions, all of these things, none of them stay. They're like clouds. They're like bubbles on the surface of the sea. They arise and we get caught by them. We favor them. We've also been talking about this, the way the brain is constructed to favor the negative, to favor the dangerous, to protect ourselves from harm is probably why we're like this. But to trust, to learn to trust that all of these things are not fixed in form and do not remain if we simply keep ourselves open. They come and go. Once we awaken to Tathagata Zen, he says, Tathagata is the word that the Buddha used to describe himself. Depending on where you put the emphasis, it's a Sanskrit word, and it means that which has thus come, but it also could mean that which has gone. So the Buddha described himself as the one who comes and goes. This coming and going Zen, this Tathagata Zen, this Buddha Zen, once we awaken to it, it's already here. It's not something to be attained. It's not something that's someplace else. It's already here. Once we awaken to it, all of the things we've been trying to do, and 10,000 is a phrase in Chinese that just means a whole lot. 10,000 good actions, and of course the six perfections, the paramitas, the different virtues that we cultivate in our practice, all of these things are already complete within us. This is really good news, because no matter how terrible we feel about ourselves, no matter how terrible we feel about the world, the direction is to keep looking, to keep being with what's here and to recognize it as it is, even if it's taking a shape or form that we don't like. This is the awakened nature. This is the Tathagata, the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Buddha, whatever you want to call it. This is it. It isn't someplace else. The Persian Sufi poet Rumi has a lovely little line that comes up in this context for me a lot. He says, keep looking at the bandaged place. Keep looking at the bandaged place. Other teachers say, don't turn away. Don't turn away from what we dislike, from what hurts us, from what agonizes us. Well, we can only do that so long, of course. We have to get a break every now and then, and we can swing back and take comfort in our sitting posture and our breath. But then the arising of what we dislike is so strong, it gets our attention, and we would love to get rid of it, we would love to run from it, or we fall in love with it and become its partner, as Hongzhi, a teacher who lived many centuries after this teacher, says. We don't have to become its partner. We don't have to run from it. We don't have to destroy it. we will try to do those things. And of course, this is slippery stuff because all those things are also the awakened nature manifesting. But this is this little bit of will that we have, the little bit of control in this uncontrolled universe that is ours. We can turn and look. We can choose to live this moment as it is with awareness and see it for what it is. See it until it reveals itself as the thing we've been longing for all our lives. And Rumi says, keep looking at the bandaged place. That's where the light enters. The light is another metaphor we've been using to talk about this awakened nature. Illumination, light, brightness, all of this clumsy attempts to talk about something that can't be named, that can't be diminished into one little word or concept, but appears before us in all shapes and forms and appears within us in all shapes and forms. In our dream, we see the six realms clearly. The six realms, as many of you know, are also a teaching from traditional Buddhism that we've adopted and adapted into the Mahayana, and especially in our modern Zen practice. The six realms of existence that we endlessly encounter in birth after birth after birth. We don't talk in Zen about rebirth because we think there's enough rebirth going on moment to moment. Every moment there's a new life. Where did that old life go? The sorrow we had just a few minutes ago is gone. And if we run after it, well, that's another form of distorted thinking, another form of delusion. So we keep going through lifetime after lifetime, just within a few minutes, through the hell realms and the hungry ghost realms, the fighting demons realms. You know what this feels like. Sometimes we get stuck here in the hell realms, the hell realm of despair, the hell realm of hunger and pain and yearning, the hell realm of anger. Sometimes we get stuck in the animal realm where everything is about satisfying the physical body. Everything is about us. Deeply, deeply narcissistic. No way to connect to this great universe. And we get stuck in the realm of the gods, where everything is really cool, and I'm happy all the time, and isn't this wonderful? We can get really stuck there. And we get stuck in the realm of being human. Maybe not such a bad place to be stuck, because the realm of being human is the place where we come up with strategies. Buddhism is a product of being human. All these teachings, centuries and centuries of ways, of technologies for awakening to what's been here from the beginning. In the traditional wheel of life and death, it has these six realms in it. In every place, in every realm, there's a bodhisattva waiting to help us to see through the delusion of being stuck in our emotions and thoughts and painful places. The bodhisattva in hell, the bodhisattva in the realm of the gods. There's one everywhere. Yasutani Roshi, another one of our Zen ancestors, says that bodhisattvas arise from the earth like grass sprouting. They arise in response to our need. So when we're in a realm, something occurs and we wake up out of it. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they say that these realms self-release. We don't even have to get out of hell. We just see through hell and we're somewhere else. So in our dream, we see the six realms clearly. There's no bad fortune, no good fortune, no loss, no gain, never seek such things in eternal serenity. And this is one of my favorite translations. We actually talked about this among the teachers, because the original translation by Robert Aitken of this text says, "Can a robot attain Buddhahood?" And we just changed it to "a wooden puppet." We thought that was a little less stuck in, I don't know, some strange science fiction-y realm. But the idea is, well, we do talk about Zen robots. You probably know some. People who have diminished themselves because they think that it's not okay to have thoughts or emotions. It's somehow important to always be good, always be perfect. But these wooden puppets, these Zen robots, can they attain Buddhahood? Yongjia asks. Well, actually, sure. But it's not our path. But if we find ourselves cutting ourselves off from the vividness and aliveness of life, we turn into these wooden puppets. We turn into these robots. And this is where the deadness arises in our hearts, where we've cut ourselves so far from our birthright of awakened nature that we feel like everything is like being in a desert. And again, remember, be careful here, because even the wooden puppets and the Zen robots and being in a desert, these two are parts of this vast awakened nature. No need to get rid of anything. Release your hold on earth, water, fire, and wind. Drink and eat as you wish in eternal serenity. All things are transient and completely empty. All things without exception are transient. Nothing to hold on to. And people, of course, don't recognize it. And this is Yongjia's teaching as well. He talks about people not recognizing the wish-fulfilling jewel, which is a Chinese legend about a jewel that is in the jaws of a dragon at the bottom of the ocean. And we have to dive down and pluck it from the mouth of the dragon, and then it will fulfill all our wishes. But the reality is that the wish-fulfilling jewel has been in our hands the whole time. We just didn't recognize it because we thought it was supposed to look like something. Look like a jewel. But it looks like this. This pain in the body, this pain in the heart, this struggling universe, this is the wish-fulfilling jewel. To begin to live a life in this way is to recognize this. Keep looking. Don't turn away. Centuries and centuries ago, this person wrote these words, and they still have a strong effect on us and can guide our path so that we too can walk the Tao together. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. We're going to have our Dharma dialogue now.
So I loved this phrase that you used, the fundamental trust. In fundamental trust in the coming and going. And I had sort of a duh moment about, oh, it's the coming and going sushi. It's not just about the people coming. So, yeah. And it seems to me that this fundamental trust is a necessary companion to turning toward the six realms, whatever realm we happen to be in. And without that companion, it's very difficult to do, because the fear comes up, right? And And so somehow this touching into that state of trust, you know, that we learn from sitting on the cushion for a lot of hours.
Yeah.
That arises, like, as its own kind of blessing that, you know, that this is accessible, this trust. And so then the turning toward is possible. So, anyway, that's it.
Oh, I love that. And you know, as you were talking, I was realizing that when we're in a realm, it's actually sometimes described as autistic. We can't know we're in a realm when we're in a realm. And once we know, it starts to self-release. So that bodhisattva who's hiding out in the realm is actually the sangha. It's the teachers. It's other... It's, we get so narrow. When we're in a realm, one of the characteristics of it is that we believe everything we think is true. And we also are stuck in that belief. So we can't maybe even touch that that heart of untrusting. But somebody else can. This is why it's so important to be in community and to receive teachings. Because we really can't do it by ourselves. It's just waiting there to unfold itself. But all we need is just a smile, a look, a touch, and it can dissolve quick if you know, if you've already been practicing the trust. At least that's what I think. But also, you can be stuck in a realm for hours, years, decades, your whole life. Some people are in hell realms. Forever, you know, it seems like many, many years. But the turn happens quick. Can happen quick.
Jeffrey.
That's almost exactly what I've been sitting with is this sort of paradox between accepting not knowing and the complete unreliability of what's coming next, and accepting and trusting that it'll be okay. So they're two, in some ways, completely different things. Accepting not knowing, you know, just this moment, just this moment, just this moment. And regardless of what this moment holds, it's okay. It's scary. It's scary just to lean into not knowing and just letting go. At least it is for me.
Yeah, I think that's... we were talking about it last night, this sort of being on the edge.
Yeah.
And the human tendency to make up the story, because we like stories, because in a story you sort of know what's going to happen next, or there's some direction. So we hold on to these stories of direction, and that we are really asked to practice this not knowing. And that in some moments it's very dramatic, as we're willing to go into something that very consciously terrifies us, but I all think it happens breath by breath, that the possibility, you know, can I trust my breath? Can I trust that if I exhale, I don't have to worry about how long or short it is? You know, this trust that happens on the sort of micro level. Sometimes you can almost feel it on a cellular level when we're in the place of not trusting. Like just grip, like, oh my God, I have to be so careful. And then other times we can feel some easing, you know, in very subtle ways. So to be at this edge and to notice the ease or the contraction, but it does require sort of faith and courage.
Yeah.
Because it is not, it is... The teaching is that we will be met. And the teaching is, if we let a little bit, if we release a little bit, we're met a little bit. If we trust a lot, we're met a lot. And if we let go, let everything be, everything rises up to teach us. So this call and response, that isn't there something about the need, or we have to ask, or, you know, that willingness to see, so important.
The asking releases the answer to us.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, a couple of more things about this too. The fear is something to not turn away from.
Right.
Yeah. So that's we don't have to be courageous. We can be afraid. Right? We can just be afraid. And the other thing I heard you say, which I thought was interesting, and I just want to use two of the words you used. You used the word unreliable, and then you used the word okay.
Unreliable and reliable. I mean, it's...
Yeah. So you know, that what's going to happen is unreliable, but we have to trust that it's going to be okay. So I heard you say.
Okay.
I want to turn that around, right? Because once you sink into this trusting heart, what's going to happen is reliable, but it might not be okay. It might be horrible. And that's why the fear, that's why the fear is so healthy, in a way, because stuff happens. Not in the vastness of the Dharma fields, but in the particular human realm, it really does happen. And we can be harmed. Thank you. Yeah, Bob.
I was really struck by Rumi's phrase, the bandage place, and just keep looking. And I think one of the things for me about practice is that I've come to see certain things that I didn't even know they were bandages. I didn't know there was something under there.
Yeah.
And that it's like, what? Wait, really? And so some, you know, an example for me has been like anger. Sometimes I'll get really angry and then I'll get into the anger, like, who's getting angry? And then what happens when the anger's not there? And then suddenly I'll realize, oh, it's like I'm bandaging some big fear. But it, from the surface, from the bird's eye view, it doesn't even look like there's a band-aid there until you sit me down on a cushion, it's a shame.
Right, right. Yeah. It just seems normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Having the privilege and the honor to come here so far every day for a portion, one of the things that I've noticed about the breath is how much space there is there in a way I've not seen before. And in September, I took a huge leap into the abyss that terrified me. And things have happened that if I knew they were going to happen, I wouldn't have jumped. And yet they've been just the right thing. Just like if I didn't have these set of conditions, I would have never stopped enough for the transformation to allow it. And I'm so grateful. So grateful that I jumped in not knowing, even terrified, to learn all of the... There was a line in something we read, you will be met and carried. And the way I've been carried has been beyond my wildest dreams, but not in the form I wanted. And one of the biggest blessings is feeling and seeing how much there is in the space that I rush to fill in ways I didn't even know I was bandaged.
Right.
Well, and I love you pointing out, and I do think it's a characteristic of the way, in a sense, of anything really worthwhile, that if we actually knew what it entailed, we probably wouldn't start. Right? You know, taking a new job, a new relationship, having children, you know, whatever. coming to the sesshin, and in that sense, but something leads us on, and then this, the nature of these places that that are so challenging is just what arises, and there is the wonderful thing about not knowing is we do crazy things like come on a Saturday morning to sit in the Zendo. And we don't know, and we encounter everything. And this sort of reliable and dependable, all these different words, it's yes and no to all of it. Utterly reliable, utterly unreliable, appearing just as necessary. And I do think our practice is, it's not about creating anything. We say over and over, it's about simply taking off some of the busyness, sort of just stopping some of the ancient scenario of the self. And then we see, oh, this is what's here. All along, I've been too busy, I've been over there, but already here, every breath, this space. Yeah. Thank you.
thank you for your talk. So, talking about falling into these realms, and I was, you know, thinking about beings in hell realms, and how it seems to me that some beings may spend their entire lifetime in hell. And that we don't actually practice in order to be released from hell, because we have no idea what the future holds. We may or may not actually be released. And it's this not being able to accept whatever realm that we're in that causes us this great difficulty. And so you were talking about how in each one of these realms there's a bodhisattva. And I was initially thinking of, oh, well, that's, you know, so we can meet this bodhisattva when we're stuck in the realm. But what then came up for me is, so what if we are the bodhisattva? Right. That is in this realm.
Exactly.
And that this is our practice, right, is the bodhisattva in hell.
Yeah.
You know? And so what kind of life is that? Is that a worthwhile life, living as the bodhisattva who practices in hell? Mm-hmm. You know, and this koan about the non-attained Buddha came up. You know, this is kalpas of practice as non-attained and living in hell and you know, whatever that means for us, that still we're alive and can practice as bodhisattvas.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this, what you're saying, I'm so touched by that way of phrasing this very difficult to understand teaching, because it's like we don't even become those bodhisattvas. We begin to recognize that we are the bodhisattva inhabiting this place. Yeah, and there's no way to be released. And it reminds me of another koan about the bodhisattva Manjushri, who's hanging out with the Buddha, like he liked to hang out with the Buddha. And, you know, Manjushri is the embodiment of emptiness. He cuts through delusion. He just lives in the realm of release, you might say. Right? He's in the middle of the... In some versions of the Wheel of Life and Death, there's nothing in the middle, and that's where you're going. You know, you're going to the core of emptiness. And in this story, there's a woman sitting in samadhi next to the Buddha, and the Buddha asks Manjushri to get her out of samadhi, and he can't do it. He can't do it because he can't do anything. And then they finally call in this other bodhisattva who lives, I don't know,
miles beneath the earth, and he rises up, you know, bursts through the earth. He's like a superhero guy, and he just snaps his fingers out. And he's not stuck in emptiness. He's one of those bodhisattvas living in one of the realms. He can do it because he's not stuck. So this is not, yeah, the ideal is not to be empty. And in fact, this text ends with it's empty and it's not empty. You know, but it's both. There's so much richness here. We don't want to just live to be released, because then what do you get?
And I love this image of the bodhisattva in hell running around trying to find the bodhisattva. I'm the bodhisattva.
Where is that bodhisattva?
It's gone. It's gone.
Right? And of course, that's the teaching that we do. We're looking somewhere else.
Yeah.
It could, like, yeah, the last place. Why is it always the last place? I thought it was the
last place. And that's why, you know, we talked about this yesterday, the idea of letting go is so dangerous, because it so much translates into modern English as getting rid of, and we're not doing that. We're not getting rid of anything. We're letting. We're allowing. We're being with, but we're not discarding. That's important. Yeah. Even the worst stuff, we want to. I just want to let it go. I love when people say that. Good luck. It's like a whack-a-mole game. You know those whack-a-mole games? I just saw a cartoon in the New Yorker, Canadian whack-a-mole, and there's a little Canadian guy saying, I'm going to say I'm sorry in advance if you miss me. sorry, Canadians. You're very nice. But you know, that you just whack one down and another pops up, and that's so. There's so much aggressive energy in this wanting to get rid of. So we do have to be careful with hurting ourselves with that concept.
There's something in the conversation and your talk and verse that just brings up for me so much the obsessiveness that we are terrorized by, you know, and the tyranny of that, trying to find the right rules to follow so that everything will be okay and that we'll be doing it right. And whether there are rules, you know, for the self we construct or someone else's rules that they want us to conform to, it's, you know, it's an exhausting burden. I was reading Parker Palmer's book, Let Your Life Speak, recently. He's a Quaker teacher. And I loved his encouragement to see God not as the God that enforces what should be, but the God of what is.
Yeah.
That's such a release.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, and I think of Zen in particular, you know, appears to have all these rules about behavior, and there's so many that we're constantly getting them wrong, and there's some way of being wrong, letting ourselves be wrong, that releases us into that what is place, you know, when we're wrong, we make a mistake, in quotes, we'll defend against it and, you know, punish ourselves and do all these things. But there's some way of going, yeah, I was wrong. That was wrong. Okay, next. That allows some real freedom in that. I think if we just let things happen the way they happen, that would be a different form of practice. But that's embedded in it, and it's very much related to what you're saying, Janine. And then, of course, what we do in Boundlessly is we keep changing the rules, which drives everybody crazy.
That's something like life, too, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Right, it is. It's a moving target. You think, I got it down. I know how to play the bell with the liturgy book. And then we change the liturgy book. We change the bell pattern. What? Yeah.
It's like raising a toddler.
Yeah. which is the toddler.
Yeah, which is the toddler.
Yeah, the teachers are the toddlers. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yes, Susan.
I just had this little vision of there's an old fashioned machine called a panopticon that has split second photos of someone who is moving. And if you look at any of the photos, the person is frozen in a position. But if you whirl it, the person is moving. And when you're in a place you don't like, you think, oh, this is a terrible place and I can't get out of it. But if you could back up, you could see, oh, well, that person is running. That person's situation is changing radically all the time.
And that's when we're stuck in a realm, we're like that person frozen in that.
Right.
Or we're like the wooden puppet that Yangji's talking about. You know, where everything's very stiff and hard, and this the Dharma is like the arm that waves stuff around.
Yeah.
Because really, everything is in flux. Nothing's stiff and hard, unless it's dead. And even then, it dissolves into its constituent elements. Yeah, so let's move along. Thank you.